It's now 2 o'clock, so I will go ahead and officially call this case. And let me know if I say this name wrong. It's Joseph Kuchta.
I believe it's Kuchta, but Kuchta is fine as well.
Kuchta?
Kuchta.
Kuchta.
Kuchta. Kuchta. All right, Joseph Kuchta, who's the appellant and plaintiff below, and Shelty Opco LLC. I won't mention the other defense parties, but because everybody knows who they are. This is case number 76566. It's the time set for the oral argument. And Mr. Henrighty is representing the appellant, Mr. Frem, for the respondent. Mr. Henrighty, do you want to reserve any time for a rebuttal argument?
At the outset, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, 2 minutes. Okay, all right, you should be able to see the timer on the screen. So you'll know when you're close to it.
Yeah, sorry, Your Honor, I had a question. I didn't know if it was going to go to 13 to reflect my first initial 13 minutes or if it was just going to start at 15 and go down until it gets to 13.
Right, yeah, if we start at 15 and count down.
Okay.
When it hits, since you're reserved 2 minutes, when it hits two, I think you hear a little bit of a beep as a reminder.
Okay, thank you, Judge.
Mm-hmm. All right, go ahead, Mr. Henrighty, with your argument.
Okay. May it please the court. Before the court is an appeal from the grant of summary judgment against Joseph Kuchta in a situation where the respondent's employee was manually operating and controlling the bowl, its speed, its force, and its movements at the time he was injured. There are three issues presented in this appeal. First, whether the district court erred in granting summary judgment based upon the erroneous findings that express assumption of the risk applied in this case. Second, whether the district court erroneously found that the respondent had no duty to the appellant under primary implied assumption of the risk and Nevada's comparative fault statute. Third, whether the district court erred in granting summary judgment based upon the assumption of the risk release where there were claims against the employee for intentionally operating the bowl in a manner contrary to the appellant's consent, inconsistent with the rider's risk assumed, and voluntarily encountered by the rider. This court, finding any one of these issues were found in error by the district court, requires this court to remand this case back to the district court for a trial by the trier of fact. The governing standard of review for each of these issues is de novo. First, the doctrine of assumption of the risk, or I should say the common law doctrine of assumption of the risk, is divided into two categories. First is express assumption of the risk. Express assumption of the risk is a contractual undertaking that expressly relieves a putative respondent from any duty of care to the injured party. Such a party has consented to bear the consequences of a voluntary exposure to a known risk. This doctrine of express assumption of the risk is based on the theory of consent. This court has previously stated in Renaud versus 200 Convention Center that for an individual to assume a risk, they must satisfy two elements. First, the individual must have voluntarily exposed himself to the danger. And second, the individual must have, quote, actual knowledge of the risk assumed. A risk can be said to have been voluntarily assumed by a person only if it was known by him and he fully appreciated it. There are a number of factors detailed in the Nevada Supreme Court's holding in Renaud to detail whether or not a person truly assumed the risk, i.e. had knowledge of the risk and voluntarily encountered the risk. And they were three that the court in Renaud laid out. One is the nature and extent of the injuries, two, the haste or lack thereof with which the release was obtained, and three, the understandings and expectations of the parties at the time of signing. For the purposes of this argument, I'm going to start with element number three because it hits on both of the other two elements. In this case, the understanding and expectations of the party at the time of signing was detailed within the complaint on file. Mr. Kuchta actually watched this same employee who operated the bowl demonstrate the bowl. He saw this same employee move the bowl with another employee's help, where she was sitting on the bowl, saw the bowl move, not in a violent manner. It wasn't throwing her around. It was moving slowly until the point where it stopped and she stepped off of it. Mr. Kuchta then asked this employee, on a scale of 1 to 10, what was that you just showed us? And that employee said that was a 2 on the scale of 10. In response to that, Mr. Kuchta says, that is what I want. I want to be able to ride the bull. I want not to be thrown off of it, and I want to be able for it to stop and for me to step off of it. These issues were never discussed by the district court judge. He never evaluated these three considerations under Renaud. This is extremely important for both the analysis under the express assumption of the risk, implied assumption of the risk, and this court, or the Nevada Supreme Court's rulings in the various cases leading up to the Turner case, Turner versus Mandalay Bay. The second element of consideration, the haste or lack thereof with which the release was obtained, was never discussed, was never even offered by the district court because we hadn't even gotten through discovery. This case was so early in the proceedings. We had just answered written discovery when the motion for summary judgment was filed. There were no depositions taken, no depositions of the employee who was operating the bowl at the time. So the district court judge failed to consider this, the second element. The third element under express assumption of the risk consideration is the nature and extent of injuries. It is clear from what has been alleged.
Mr. Hanratty?
Yes.
Is there any particular reason the plaintiff did not file a request to have the summary judgment decision extended so further discovery could be completed?
That was a part of our opposition, Judge, that we said that under Rule 56F that discovery had not yet been completed to establish the basis of the analysis under express assumption of the risk, i.e. that there was a duty owed by the employee to Mr. Kuchta. In fact, the only thing that the district court found was that express assumption of the risk applied and the language booted his case without any analysis under Renaud. The third element, the nature and extent of the injuries, it is clear from the allegations in the complaint that Mr. Kuchta didn't even expect to be thrown from the bowl. He didn't expect the bowl to be moved in any manner where he could sustain any injury. It is clear from the allegations in the complaint that Mr. Kuchta alleged that he saw this employee, the same employee that actually operated the bowl, operated in a safe manner. It stopped and she stepped off of it. And that is exactly what he said he wanted before he even signed the release. And again, I can't represent anything that's not in the record.
Mr. Hanratty, does that conversation then somehow modify or supplement what's in the written release?
It absolutely does, Your Honor, because under the considerations under Renaud, the court in Renaud actually found that the district court didn't have the ability to grant summary judgment because they didn't know what the releasee understood the risk was and whether he voluntarily encountered that risk. In fact, in this case, when we determine what exactly was discussed, it is imperative for the trial court before granting summary judgment to determine that there was a duty or there was not a duty. In this case, they just said because the release language says there's not a duty, then there's not a duty. Under Renaud, that's the Nevada Supreme Court said, no, that's not the standard. You need to evaluate these considerations.
So, Mr. Henry, let me ask you, you keep talking about how they didn't assuming the risk because they saw this other patron, this other unknown patron who's not a friend of theirs, just some stranger on the bull, and that person got off the bull without safely, right? So let me ask you this. Mr. Kuchta sued, that's this case. But Mr. Bodner, his friend, also sued. In that case, to my understanding, it has settled. So one of them gets on the bull first, gets thrown off the bull, and gets hurt to the point where a lawsuit is filed. Why does the other guy then get on the bull?
Well, Your Honor, if I can just correct your statement, Mr. Kuchta didn't watch another individual. I don't know, the record doesn't reflect whether Mr. Kuchta watched any other individual other than the employee demonstrate the bull. Right,
that's fine. Okay, so it's the employee that you're going off of. But then, after the employee gets off safely, then one of these two guys, either Kuchta or his friend, gets on the bull, gets thrown off to the point, it gets injured where they sue. Then the other guy gets on the bull. Why does the other guy get on the bull then?
Well, because there was an understanding between Mr. Kuchta and the employee about this, what the ride was going to be. There has to be some expectation, and that's one of the elements under Renaud, the understanding and expectations of the parties. Mr. Kuchta was not there when he told the other riders were not there when they told what they wanted. Mr. Kuchta's position was, I want a 2 out of 10. I want exactly what you demonstrated to me prior to me getting on the bull. He has that expectation because that is the knowledge, and that is what he is voluntarily encountering in this case.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, you keep saying that Mr. Kuchta had this agreement, but and maybe I'm missing something. Maybe I, you know, so, and if I am, please let me know. But my reading of the deposition is Kuchta doesn't say that. He hears his friends say that. Is that correct?
Sorry, hear his friend.
Kuchta didn't have this conversation with the operator. Doesn't he testify that he heard his friend tell the operator that that his group wanted a lighter ride or a level 2 ride? Because I don't recall Mr. Kuchta actually personally testifying in his deposition that he himself said that to the ride operator.
Well, there is some dispute in the record as to whether he said it. Mr. Kuchta has represented to me he said it, but that's not in the record. What has been alleged is that all three watched this employee. All three said, that is what we want. We do not want to be thrown from the bull. The second element of assumption of the risk is implied assumption of the risk. Implied assumption of risk is broken into two categories. The first category is primary implied assumption of the risk, and this is an issue as to whether or not the district court determines whether there's a duty. And primary implied assumption of the risk may be described as resulting from a relationship that the appellant voluntarily accepts involving a lack of duty on the respondent's part. The moment this court determines as a matter of law and a matter of public policy that we aren't going to allow assumption of the risk releases to release circumstances like this where an employee has actual control, manipulative control. This is not like getting onto a roller coaster and you flip a switch and the roller coaster just goes. This is a roller coaster that is manipulated, the speed is controlled, the ferocity of this roller coaster is controlled, and the manipulation of its movement is controlled by the employee. There has to be a duty on that employee's part that takes it outside of primary implied assumption of the risk, which is the court determining whether there is a duty. The moment there's a duty, then we move to secondary implied assumption of the risk and the holding in Turner versus Mandalay Bay, where the Nevada Supreme Court said, hey, listen, we don't like the assumption of the risk. It's confused and masqueraded as contributory negligence, and we're not going to put ourselves in this position. It's a doctrine that faces backwards instead of more accountability on the parties. And for that reason, this court must determine that express assumption of the risk was wrongly decided, and the facts, the district court did not go through the elements under Renaud, and that there was a duty owed by the respondent's employee to Mr. Kuchta, The moment that respondent's employee has a duty, it boils down to secondary implied assumption of the risk, which under Turner is a contributory negligence standard and should have been dealt with at the district court level in that regard. I'll submit it on that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Henready. You have a minute and 35 seconds left for rebuttal. All right. Mr. Frem, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. May it please the court. I see this case as pretty straightforward issue of applying normal rules of contract interpretation to this release agreement. That's what the district court did down below when it decided the motion for summary judgment in my client's favor and basically got rid of all the claims for relief that were alleged against my client as the owner of the premises where the mechanical bull was located. Looking at the trial court's order, he basically found three separate things in the order granting summary judgment. The first was that the agreement that was signed by the appellant in this case prior to him engaging in the mechanical bull activities was a valid, enforceable waiver of liability, which liability meaning liability under any theory that could involve negligence or claims of negligence, which is all but one of the claims in the appellant's complaint in this matter. The second issue that the trial court found in favor of my client was that, again, there was the contract that was signed by appellant constituted an express assumption of the risks involved in engaging in the activities of riding the mechanical bull. And then finally, the trial court also found that with regard to the one intentional tort claim that was pleaded by appellant, that the appellant consented via that contract to the activities and the risks that were associated with the activities riding the mechanical bull. In this particular case, Your Honors, normal rules of contract interpretation in Nevada require courts, like the trial court down below, to enforce the terms of that contract as written, assuming that the terms of that contract are clear and unambiguous. The same holds true to any contractual agreement that in which a party seeks to be, to waive liability for certain activities. And in this particular case, the exculpatory clause that's contained as part of the waiver agreement that appellant signed is enforceable. It's about as clear and unambiguous language as you can see. It's part of appellant's appendix, document number one, entitled Assumption of Risk, Release, Indemnity, and Medical Treatment Authorization Agreement. It details out in the contract term that was signed by appellant, which again is an undisputed material fact, that he was waiving any cause of action he had for any negligence type of claims against the owner, operator, their employees, as it pertains to the mechanical bull ride there at the at Gillies.
Mr. Frum, let me just interrupt you for a moment.
Yes, Your Honor.
This type of contract, and we can call it a contract or a written waiver, it is really an adhesion contract, is it not?
Well, Your Honor, I'd have to say no, it's not, because the participant who desires to ride the mechanical bull, they can decide not to ride.
Well, Mr.
So they either sign the agreement.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. We've been so good all day, and I apologize for talking over you. Mr. Kuchka, though, he did not get to negotiate that contract. That contract or that waiver was presented to him, and if he wanted to ride the bull, he'd have to sign it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And these contracts typically are pretty strictly construed and against the drafter of the contracts, correct?
That's what the law on the subject says, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say the trial judge down below, Your Honor, did apply the four factors under Nevada law that have been established for determining whether these type of waivers of liability are enforceable, and did find in favor of each of those elements as it pertained to a valid and enforceable waiver of liability in this particular case.
And he also, thank you, and he also applied it to the battery claim, correct?
He did, Your Honor, and it was kind of one of those things in the court's order. He basically said, well, if you look at the express terms of this agreement, it's clear that the plaintiff consented to the activity and any potential harm that could come from the plaintiff using that mechanical bull. So he did find an express consent to the activity that Mr. Kucha undertook in that particular situation.
Now, your client would instruct its employees to demonstrate the bull rides. Was that something they did in the course and scope of their employment on a regular basis?
Your Honor, I don't know if there was an express requirement as part of the employee's duties to demonstrate it to potential participants, or whether or not it was just something that was done occasionally. That's not clear from the record.
Go ahead,
Your Honor. I'll take your question.
Okay. I'm just concerned about this one issue, and I'd like your input on it. Whether you think that Mr. Kuchka's, and I apologize if I mispronounced his name, if his expectation of the ride was changed based on his observation of the employee's ride, i.e. that the employee got on the bull, got off the bull, and was not injured. Do you think that that changed his expectation of the fact that I can get on this ride, ride the bull, and get off the bull uninjured versus the actual written waiver itself? Because clearly the waiver does talk about the injuries that someone could sustain.
It does, Your Honor. And, you know, in this particular case, it's a little blurred. The two issues, the enforceability of the contractual waiver of liability and then the express assumption of the risk in that agreement, they kind of go hand in hand. But the case law on the subject says that courts have to analyze each of the subjects, the contractual waiver of liability and the express assumption of risk, separately. And in this particular case, the first issue I kind of touched on, the trial judge did make the findings that the language of that waiver of liability contractual provision did comport with Nevada law and therefore was enforceable. But then the judge went a step further and found an alternative basis under express assumption of the risk. And that's where I think, you know, this case is about as cut and dry as you can get. If you look at the language, Your Honor, whatever Mr. Kuchta's subjective expectations may have been about what the extent of the bull ride was going to be or not, it's clearly spelled out in the assumption of risk portion of that agreement. It talks about all the risks involved, including that the mechanical bull jerks and spins violently and unexpectedly. There is a significant risk that I will be seriously injured as a result of me participating in the mechanical bull riding program. And it goes on saying that he understands that there is a risk of injury. That's exactly what happened here, Your Honor. Mr. Kuchka signed the agreement. He didn't have to sign the agreement, but he proceeded with it. And it was under the typical rules of contractual interpretation, the clear and unambiguous language of the assumption of the risk part of that agreement should be applied here and preclude Mr. Kuchta's claims. And that's where I think the trial court analyzed it from that perspective and got it right at the end of the day when he applied typical rules of contractual interpretation here.
Mr. Frem,
yes,
this is Gibbon speaking. I don't think there's really any doubt about that. I mean, there's no contest about this agreement being invalid in and of itself. The question is it somehow modified because the employee demonstrated a slow bull ride? And if the appellant, through his friends, that supposedly are having a joint discussion with this same employee saying, can you repeat this ride? That's what we want. We want a two. Two means very little movement. Nice, easy ride. We want to be able to step off of it. Does that somehow modify the the example of the slow ride and then the conversation confirming that that's what they wanted and not the type of ride that's described in the waiver where jerking, bouncing, bowl, where you would typically expect. So is it any different?
Your Honor, I would say no, it's not. It's a fully incorporated agreement. Whatever parole evidence or whatever things were said or done surrounding the bull ride prior to Mr. Kuchta getting the agreement in front of him, reading it presumably, and even if he didn't read it, it's presumed under the law that he did read it and understood it. He signed it, so therefore I think you have to apply normal rules of contractual interpretation there, and those, as the court's aware, they state when you have a clear and unambiguous agreement from its terms, it's fully incorporated like this agreement, parole evidence cannot be used to vary or undercut the terms of the agreement. And that's what we have here, Your Honor. I don't think the expectations that he may have generated from observing another patron or employee using the bull in one context or a certain level of ride, we'll just use the term 2 out of 10 or whatnot, I don't think that changes the effectiveness of the agreement that he ultimately signed and agreed to.
Does it matter that there's no clause in the agreement that says parole evidence can't be used to modify it?
I'll be honest with you, Your Honor. I don't know the answer, but I will say this. I mean, it doesn't refer to any, you see those kind of contract terms all the time, say, but, you know, modified, you know, somebody could write it in or do something modified via, you know, instructions I gave the employee and see if that would be accepted. But that's just not the case here. The agreement says what it says. It says that Mr. Kuchta understood that there were risks associated with this, including bucking, rapid movements, and personal injuries of certain types. Okay. He agreed to
Mr. Frum, that might be correct on the express waiver part of it. What about the assumption of the risk and applying the Renaud case and the third sub-factor about determining the intentions of the parties? I mean, how does that interplay with this if that's not allowed under parole evidence? I mean, how do you ever determine the intentions of people?
Well, Your Honor, I guess there has to be a rule where you have to look at certain agreements like this one that is pretty detailed about what risks are involved in a particular activity, what injuries can occur from it, and look at the express language here and say that it is broad enough to apply in a situation like this where there could be some issue as to what somebody's subjective intent was. But you can't allow parole evidence in every case, Your Honor, because otherwise there would be, I don't know, contract disputes would go on. There'd never be a meeting of the minds in this particular case. If there was some question about the scope of the contractual assumption of the risk, it should have been handled at the time. Mr. Kuchta should have made sure that it was in here, that there was a reservation or some limitation on the scope of the release. That did not happen.
Well, I certainly agree. You can't do it in every case. And in the vast majority of cases, if you get on the roller coaster at New York, New York, you're taking the ride that they give you. But is it different in this case because they had an actual demonstration and then a conversation to say, we want a ride that conforms with the demonstration? So this is not every case. This is a very unusual case.
Again, Your Honor, it would just be my position that if you look at Nevada law as it pertains to the admissibility of parole evidence on a contract issue, a written contract, that is not proper to be utilizing parole evidence to determine what somebody's intent may be when you have a clear and unambiguous agreement as to what the extent of the risk that was going to be engaged in by the person and the risks associated with engaging in that activity.
Well, and let me ask this question in a minute. I would like to hear what Mr. Hanrider's response to the same question is, but isn't there another element here, which is, as far as the record shows, and I know that Mr. Hanrider said he had a private conversation with his client, but it's not in the record. As far as the record shows, Mr. Kuchta didn't have this conversation. It's Ms. Bodner who does. So can Ms. Bodner's conversation with the employee change Mr. Kuchta's contract?
I would say no, Your Honor, because she's not a party to that particular contract. It's separate and distinct. It has really, well, it may go to Mr. Puchka's expectations or subjective expectations, but she's not a party to that contract. So I'd say, no, it's not proper evidence to look at on that subject. And it shouldn't have been considered by the district court below in its decision on the summary judgment issue on the express assumption of the risk element. And then last but not least, go ahead, Judge.
Oh, I'm sorry. But let's just assume, leaving the waiver contract aside for a moment, the employee who has control over the mechanical bull hears the discussion, no matter who said it, we want a 2 out of 10 ride. We want like a ride like you just had. Does that in and of itself change expectations? Now, especially in this case when discovery really hadn't gotten underway, and as far as I know, no experts were disclosed.
That's correct, Your Honor. It was based upon the terms of the contract, which, as you know, trial courts have the ability to render summary judgment on contract cases when the facts aren't in dispute and the contract language is deemed to be clear and unambiguous on the subject. So I apologize. I'm over my time, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your input.
All right. Excuse me, Mr. Frim, one more question. Mr. Hanratty represented that discovery was an issue below. The district court order doesn't mention the word discovery when it granted summary judgment. Is this actually something that was in front of the district court?
Your Honor, I'll be honest with you. I can't recall. It wasn't part of one of the issues that came up on appeal. I don't recall specifically. There may have been some mention in the briefs below that Mr. Hanratty, on behalf of his client, did ask for additional discovery under 56F to potentially create an issue of a material fact on the summary judgment issues, but I don't specifically recall.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Frim, again. All right, Mr. Hanratty, you have a short time here for a rebuttal. Go ahead.
Your Honor, I'll try and get through the question as quickly as possible. I want the court to concentrate on the rulings from the Nevada Supreme Court. And specifically, there is one decision, the Turner decision, that where the dissenting judges, both Justice Gibbons, Justice Douglas, and Justice Cherry, both concurring and dissenting in the findings of the district court in Turner, said that the determinative issue under a general duty analysis is whether such a relationship exists between the parties that the community will impose a legal obligation upon one for the benefit of the other. This is a case, regardless of what the discussions were, this is a case where this employee had control over the bull. This is not a case where there's an express assumption of the risk, because it has been admitted by the respondent that there was no representation about the discussions at the district court level. What is imperative for this court to understand is, as a community, meaning as a state and as a court, do we want to enforce these provisions where the Nevada Supreme Court in Mitsushima, a totally different court which was analyzing this case 20 years prior to the Turner case, said this doctrine faces backwards. It emphasizes escape more than accountability, inertia more than progress. This is exactly what's happening in this case. There is control by this employee, takes it out of the express assumption of the risk.
Okay. All right. I believe that's the conclusion of your time there, Mr. Hanratty. So this case has a number of issues. Like you said, they're significant. And we'd like to talk a lot longer, but this is the standard procedure, so we're going to call it a conclusion here. This matter will be taken under submission by the court, and we'll be issuing a written decision.